Hannah Montana's guitar behind us right now. We just heard from the Child of Love, L-O-V. Song's called Heal, H-E-A-L. From a CD, self-titled. Stephen Malkmus and Friends, covering Kan's Egi Bamyasi under the name Kan's Egi Bamyasi, played by Stephen Malkmus and Friends. And it's rather strange. It was recorded live in Cologne in this past December. And it's not like Pavement covering Kan. It's a kind of paint by numbers. It's, you know, musicians hired because they could play like Kan, and they just kind of do the record exactly. Not like they did Faust's It's a Rainy Day Sunshine Girl, which we heard last week. Still sounds great, though. Spoon, we heard. Stephen Malkmus and Friends covering Kan. No Joy, who will be my guest on the program next week. The new CD is called Wait to Pleasure. We heard Hair Tarot Lies. Hey, everybody, thanks for listening. It's been a joy. And I'll see you next week. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information is coming right up.
You are listening to Too Much Information on WFMU. My name is Benjamin Walker. One of the things I hope to do with this new version, this reboot of the show, is to get more artists onto the program. Studio visits, gallery and museum exhibits. The Italian artist Paolo Ventura takes photographs, builds models of buildings and people, and he's also a painter. I met up with him at the Hasted Krautler Gallery in Chelsea for a tour of his new show, The Infinite City.
Okay, my name is Paolo Ventura. I am an artist, and I'm here in my gallery, which is Hasted Krautler in New York City, in Chelsea. And I'm here because I opened my new show, and the title is The Infinite City.
And what is this city? Where does this city exist on the map?
Oh,
is it in your head?
Just there, just in my fantasy. It's an imaginary city. When I was little, I used to take the train to go everywhere, basically, with my family, because we are moving with the train a lot. And it's in Italy, of course, and enter to Milan or other cities with a train. I always love it because you can see the city from the side, you know, because the train enter into the city, and you can see the city on your left, on your right, very close to the houses, and you have a perfect view of the center of the city. And so I always thought about that. And so it's that city. It's the city when you enter with the train, you see the profile, you close, but you're outside.
So we have an actual model of this city here, which looks like we would be, if we were on a train, we'd be coming this way, right?
And exactly. This is the model that I use. They are like made in cardboard and then painted. They are 40, and this is the model that I use to photograph and then make the final work.
So you made 40 buildings here out of cardboard.
Yes, and then use the 40 buildings for making the work. You know, that's my city. You know, it's and then you're making like this small print and they paint on the print. I painted because painting, I can take off stuff I'm not interested to see. I can take off houses or change the shape of the houses. So they allowed me to manipulate the images even after.
Yeah, but these are buildings you've built. So like if we look at these four here, see so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So you photographed 8 buildings.
Oh, yeah.
That you made.
Yes.
And then you painted onto the photograph.
Yes, exactly. Also because you see here behind that building is, you see my studio, you don't see anymore. So I use the paint to take off the part I don't want you to see and isolate the houses. It became like foggy scene of this imaginary city.
Yeah, and you don't want to use computers at all. This is sort of a very old-fashioned hand do-it-yourself way of doing something you could do differently, no?
Yeah, well, I would like to use a computer, but I don't know how exactly, so I prefer old system, just work for me. There's not any other decision. I mean, it's not just because I'm not that good in computers, so it's...
You know, I love how some of them have this sort of faded gray, you know, you use the word cloudy, but it seems that this city exists in a very much of a fog, no?
Oh, yeah.
Wintertime?
Yeah, I come from Milan, which is famous to be foggy. So it's always this memory of me getting up in the morning, going to school, and it was always deep fog. And, you know, turning my back to say hi to my mother, which is waiting on the window, and I couldn't see her. So I was waiting, waving the nothing, you know, just this wall of light, of white light, you know.
So tell me a little bit more about this city, because it seems that, you know, the way you describe it, we're coming on a train, we're just, you know, passing through, it's foggy, but, you know, you've obviously, look at it, we've got like, you know, 60, 70 pictures from this city, so 100. So tell me what you've learned about this city in your mind.
Do you know, it's a part of the Calvino story, the imaginary city, the invisible city. And he described this city, which is reflecting himself in a canal. So there's two cities that they look each other, but they hate each other. So I have the same relationship with the city. I grew up in a city. I love the city. But at the same time, I hate the city. So I try to create a place where I would like to be. This is my work all the time. I try to create place because it's is only in my mind. It's in my fantasies. I can create a place where I could be comfortable there. So I created a kind of shape of house, which is for me is the ideal shapes, which is the square and the other shape, which is mostly the building you find in Italy, is these two shapes. And I try to make this place where there's a little neighbors and then empty space, neighbor, empty space, alternate the two things. It's not timeless place. It's not people live there. So it like was abandoned. It's a strange place, but where it can be comfortable.
Yeah. Now you talked about the two cities hating each other. You mentioned earlier you live in the country. You don't live in a big city. Is there something, you know, but as an artist, you know, the city is always, here we are in New York where, you know, last night you had your opening. There were many, many people here. It's hard to be an artist and have parties like that in the country. But do you have like a, you know, an antagonistic relationship with the city?
I love the city, so that's why I decided to go to live in a country. I prefer the memory of the city than to actually live in the city and deal with the bad things. Like this, I can imagine like city as I want and, you know, work in the city, build in the city, but then stay away and have a better view from the city.
So you have the best of both ways.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 I'm living with these houses and even more bigger models all day. Oh, yeah. So I kind of like in my own world, and I prefer to be there than in the real one.
So in some of these drawings, the city fades in, fades out, and then disappears. What's going on here? Where are these buildings going? Or is this just the fog?
It's not only the fog. It's the way to we cancel our memory, you know? It's they destroy old building to make a new one, making holes. The city were built in a certain way one time ago. I don't want to be nostalgic about, but... And now we have this capacity, the city, which is also the good things about New York, for example, destroy the old to make new, you know, make this enormous hall, and then one morning is a new buildings, and you cancel tradition, memories, and etc. So it became a live place, but in the same time, you kill them, you know, it's infinite city, I call it infinite city, because... Each picture is ever that the edge are free, so you can switch the images as much time as you want, you know? So you can put this one here and these images on the left, and with hundreds, you have an infinite possibility to make your own skyline. So it's the city's going forever.
I see. No, let's say that again. So I can ask you a question. So this is not just your imaginary city, but you call it the infinite city. What do you mean by that? Like when I'm looking at this skyline here, what does it mean to be, how is this an infinite city?
It's infinite city because when I was little, I thought this the city where I lived was infinite. I never left the city for a long time. So, and to me, it was infinite. And then also what happened now with the cities in Europe, at least, you know, they became infinite because they start to, they went up and they grow. A certain time, you don't notice the difference between one city and the other one.
That happens in America, too.
So it's a common problem. So with 100 images, you can switch millions times and it became an infinite skyline. You can make your own city for the rest of your life, switching the photograph, and have always different skyline, and that's why I call it infinite.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about the story that we have here in the back. You know, you've done some very amazing, beautiful narrative works, and we have a story that's included in the show about the magician. So maybe we read the text first, yeah. And then we talk about some of these images.
Okay, the title of the story is The Magician, and I did the story with me and my son, The Magician. In variety shows from west to east, the bill was topped by a great artist. The finest number that he did was a vanishing trick with a little kid. Who'd wait in a square till the end of the show, and then together home they go. But one gray day, the cheeky pup just disappeared, did not turn up. Desperate searching in the mist, but the little rogue did not exist. In the fog of Milan, he saw it in vain, and only in dreams saw the kid again.
So
Sorry for my back.
No. It's a beautiful reading. So here we are. So we see this story illustrated here on the wall, or at least a kid disappearing.
The kid disappeared and never show up again. I work in my studio in a very simple way. I paint in this backdrop for and change each scene almost. And then I paint myself as well to integrate me with the backdrop, which is painted. And then my wife takes a picture of us and we perform on the stage. Very, very simple. You know, backdrop, a little wood pedal, yeah. And that's it.
It looks like this kid is not disappearing on purpose, but maybe the magician messed up.
Yeah, it's a bad magician.
He says, "Uh-oh, I don't want to go."
Yeah, I don't want to go. What he's doing? I was not really afraid. He don't want to do it. You know, after 10 minutes, he was bored, and so we. You want cookies? So be afraid. But he liked it. It was a beautiful for me, my wife, and my son, which his name is Primo, and it was a fun day we had.
Yeah, that's great.
He helped me also to paint the backdrop, so it was kind of part of the process.
I see. And is this the magician here looking for the?
Yeah, that's when you're waiting to go home together.
Okay.
Then one day he never show up, so he's looking for him, and then the fog start to raise, and then it's desperate searching for him and never find again.
So it seems to me, coming back to the infinite city, and we end with this panel of a larger one of some of these buildings, that somewhere in the city is your son.
Yeah, well, you know, artists, I think, have a certain perception, and as far as you can go, you always go back in the same perception. So I've been working with the same things all over and over because that's my perception. Cities, the disappear, the creating new imaginary world, invent stories. That's what I love and then what I'm doing.
Paolo Ventura's show, The Infinite City, is on display at the Hasted Krautlier Gallery in Chelsea until June 22nd. Our next guest is the author James Lasden. He's the author of the book Give Me Everything You Have. It's an official accounting of his experiences with an online stalker and self-described verbal terrorist. The title gives you a hint of just what's at stake in this story, but it all begins inauspiciously in a creative writing class that Lasden teaches in New York City. We recorded this conversation at my apartment. Now, I'm curious, if we were making the Hollywood movie version of this first scene where you encounter your future antagonist, Nazreen, that would be very important. And I'm wondering if you can sort of set that up for us. The first, do you remember exactly the first time that you noticed her in the class?
I don't, actually. I mean, I remember the class. I remember that she was very quiet. I remembered her as a very reticent student, somebody who didn't participate in the discussion much. And I think we all sat around a table in that particular class, but some people sort of didn't sit at the table, sat at the back. And I have a vague memory of her sitting at the back. So not a very vivid presence. So I think it was a few weeks before her work came up. But when it did come up, I was very struck by it. I thought she was very talented. And I encouraged her. I mean, she was writing something. She was writing a novel about her family's escape from Iran during the 1979 revolution. And she just had a chapter or two done. But it was a big story. It had some real sort of depth and scale, and it was an interesting one. It had politics in it, had interesting characters, and I felt that she was talented. And you know, it's rare to see someone who, I mean, it's a graduate class, so they're fairly advanced, but it's rare to see something that you think, oh, this really could get published, and this is somebody who could have a career.
So in your book, you call this Morgan College. And again, we should mention that you use pseudonyms and names for all of the characters and the institutions in the book. But when I think of a graduate-level writing class, it seems like it's a small number of students. No? You say the back of the room. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's that crowded.
No, it's not crowded. I mean, probably there were 18 students in that class. But still, you can, you know, there are ones who want to get, there are some students who are very extrovert and want to dominate the discussion, or at least take part in it in a very sort of engaged way, and then there are others who sit quietly and don't say much. And sometimes what they do have to say is a lot more interesting than the people who talk a lot, and sometimes it isn't. You never know. You never know who you're going to get.
Yeah, but it's interesting that you first sort of take note of her on paper, not in person.
Yes, yes. And
which resonates throughout. You know, the story is dealing with this person who's writing you emails, and then
The written word was her medium, or the typed out word. That was her medium of expression. And
so you meet in the class. The trouble doesn't start there.
No. All goes fine there. I mean, I encouraged her. I thought she was talented. I was her thesis advisor, so I met with her a couple of times. You know, during the course of the semester, but not very often. That's the way it's set up. It's not a very big thing. And she graduated, and that was it. I thought that, you know, she was going off into her career. And I didn't hear from her, and didn't expect to hear from her. 2 years passed, and then she got in touch again, and she asked if I would work with her on her novel. I didn't want to, because I wasn't teaching then. I was working on my own stuff. I was busy, and I didn't want to be involved in any kind of teaching stuff or student stuff. But I thought well enough of her. I remembered her very well, and I thought well enough of her to recommend her to my agent. So I did that, but my agent felt that she wasn't ready to sign up. I mean, she still only had a few chapters of this book. But my agent sent her to a freelance editor who worked with her, and that all seemed to go fine. And in the course of this, Nasreen, as I call her, and I began corresponding by email. I mean, I live out in upstate New York, and she was in the city, I think. So everything was by email. And it was very amicable.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, it became clear that, you know, she was thinking that this was going to lead to an affair. And I made it clear that I was happily married. And she seemed to take that fine. I mean, she sent a very gracious email in reply. And so we continued corresponding. But then at a certain point, I realized that it wasn't as simple as that. Her emails grew in quantity. I mean, they were still perfectly fine in content, but gradually there were more and more of them. And I answered fewer and fewer of them, and I asked her to kind of ease up. And she sort of said, oh, I've got to let you be for a bit. And there were one or two things that happened in the course of that. She started forwarding other people's correspondence that made me wary of her. I suddenly thought, well, did I misjudge this person? Is she not quite the person that I thought she was? And a lot of the book is about me going back on my earlier judgments, my earlier assessments of the situation, and revisiting them in the light of what happened later, and, you know, seeing the things, or looking for the things that I might have missed. And I at a certain point, I basically stopped answering her emails altogether.
And then, so this obviously is a story that unfolds over many years that this goes on for. But I'm curious, for when you were dealing with this at the time, when you were talking to your friends or colleagues, and, you know, having an online start, like, what was the example that you would reach out to try to get one of your friends to understand this is really bad?
Well, when it turned from harmless but high volume emails, during which I didn't really talk to anybody about it. It just seemed weird and a little disturbing. I mean, I talked to my wife about it, but, you know, I didn't think that much of it. I was traveling also during a lot of that time. But then overnight, practically, in the summer of 2007, it turned to hate mail, and it turned to accusations, defamatory postings, emails to my employers, an explosion of sort of hatred and rage and attempts, as she put it, to ruin me. She actually said to one of the other people, I wasn't the only person she was sending this stuff to. I think I was the main person at that time, but my agent and the editor she had worked with also became targets of this of this campaign. And she accused me, first of all, of plagiarizing her work for a story I had written. then she accused me and my agent and this other woman of being part of a conspiracy to steal her work and sell it to other writers, other young Iranian women writers who had just, there'd just been a spate, really, of novels published by young women of Iranian descent. And they did, I think, I mean, I didn't read any of them, but
they
think...
They were big. They were in the news.
A couple of them were big hits, and I think they covered similar ground to her novel. They were about, their families had also fled Iran.
You see how that could contribute to putting someone over the edge, for
absolutely,
sure.
Absolutely. I mean, every writer is a little bit paranoid that somebody else is writing their book.
But if you were meeting a friend for a drink or a coffee and you wanted to sort of explain that this is a real serious thing without sort of going through the whole story, what example would you reach for when saying, like, look, this is serious?
Oh, well, once it began, it was so immediately serious. It was so shocking. There was this explosion of anti-Semitism. There was these incredibly violent... The language was so violent. I mean, I would just read... I mean, I did have one friend that I talked to quite a lot about it, and I would just read him some of these things as they came in, and they're very violent, and they're even people who have absolutely nothing to do with me, even cops actually read them and are quite sort of visibly shocked. I mean, there is an energy of antagonism and malice in them that I had never seen in my life, and I don't think very many people have. And it wasn't just like a one-off explosion. It was this thing that was happening day in, day out, many emails a day. And she was constantly escalating the level of malice too. I mean, it began at a pretty high volume, and it just went on getting higher. So that aspect of it was immediately communicable. I mean, I could read someone an email, and they would say, "My God, what's going on?" Yeah. You know, they would get that. But it was still a difficult thing. Well, it was a very difficult thing to do anything about. You know, I fairly early on, I actually realized this is serious, and because I felt quite vulnerable to some of the things that she was saying. I mean, if you're a guy, if you teach, you're a writer.
Rape accusations are a little scary. Exactly. To open your email inbox and see something like that, I could see you having a heart attack.
It's very disturbing. I mean, she didn't actually accuse me of raping her, but she accused me of having her drugged and raped, which is, you know, it's not much better.
It's just as heart attack.
Yeah. I mean, you do not want to be associated with that word. I mean, it is very scary. And you feel that however crazy, however far-fetched the scenario she's painting is, which, you know, having somebody drugged and raped is pretty far-fetched. You feel that however far-fetched it is, the people who are getting sent those allegations are going to wonder, well, what did happen? There isn't going to be this much smoke without fire. And you know, when she got to sending people who employed me these allegations, I mean, they have a responsibility to take that kind of thing seriously. So
absolutely, and we'll come to some of those. But I'm curious if you could. I want to ask you about something that's, you know, throughout the whole story is that, you know, you mentioned that you were being CC'd on some of these attacks, so you could see who she was sending them to, but not all of them. So not only are you dealing with the obvious evidence that you have in front of you in your inbox of what she's saying to you, you have these terrifying questions in the back of your mind or the front of your mind. Who else is this going to?
Well, that's one of the things that she was, I don't know if this was part of her intention or just a kind of byproduct, but, you know, the internet induces paranoia very easily because you never know who's seeing these postings and you never know where else she's posting these things. Yeah. This was one of the reasons I had to go on reading the emails and why the police, in fact, told me I have to go on reading them and not block them, not change my email addresses, because I realized how damaging these things could be. And I felt I needed to kind of keep an eye on them. And because I didn't always know where she was posting things, sometimes she would let me know in an email, sometimes she wouldn't. I got into this ridiculous sort of compulsive self-Googling thing where I just was trying to, see.
But you could never know. Even if you Googled anything, you would never know everything. In fact, in the book, you have this encounter with a woman you meet in Israel at the end. And she seems to be, you meet in the hallway, you're on this trip, you have this little connection, you're going to make plans for later. And then she, for some reason, stands you up. And it's this wonderful aside where I felt as the reader sort of identifying with your terror, like, okay, did she blow me off because she Googled me? And...
Yeah, well, I mean, let me clarify. This wasn't a kind of date type thing. This was somebody who was going to take me to show me a camp in Ramallah. But yeah, it was very strange. And it fed into the general state of mind I was in then, which was by that point one of really acute insecurity about what, you know, about this public aspect of myself that everybody has this, well, certainly every writer has it, which the word reputation seems to cover, this layer of yourself that's sort of in the hands of other people, and that I felt to have been tremendously damaged or tremendously threatened at any rate.
Yeah, threatened. Now, you go to the police eventually, and the police officer you speak with does explain to you that you can't block he suggests to you not to block the emails. Can you explain why? You just talked about it a little bit, but can you sort of spell it out? Why you were advised, why someone who's being harassed like this doesn't just block or ignore? Because that would be most people's reaction, like, okay, goodbye.
Yeah, well, for one thing, she kept changing her email address. So even if I'd blocked them, I mean, she just kept coming up with new ones. She said she assumed I was blocking them. I felt that I needed to know what was going on in the because she was expanding the circle of people to whom she was sending emails about me, and sometimes she would CC me them. But the police, their main reason was that the level of threat, she escalated to threats against me and then against my family, tried to contact my daughter. What she was doing was aggravated harassment, which is a misdemeanor. If she had been in New York, she left New York, but if she'd stayed in New York, I was told she would have been arrested immediately for these emails. However, she had moved to California, and in order to arrest her, they would have had to extradite her. They don't do that for misdemeanors, or only very rarely do they do that. So I was in the weird position of wanting to find threats that raised what she was doing to the level of a felony so that they could extradite her. So I was basically hoping for death threats in my email, which is an extremely weird position to be in, because only if she escalated her threats to that kind of level, it seemed, would the police actually be able to do something about it, extradite her and bring her to face charges. So,
other than that, did you get any help from the police? I mean, you feel that like they were helping you at
all? Yeah, I felt they were very sympathetic. I've had. My initial attempt was farcical to get law enforcement involved. My initial attempt was I called the FBI because I thought, in my naivety, I thought, well, she's sending me anti-Semitic hate mail, it must be a hate crime. So I call up the FBI to report a hate crime, and you know, I realized very quickly that they thought A, that I was some crazy guy as I told them the story, but B, as they began to take it a bit more seriously, they explained that, you know, it's not just anti-Semitism, it's got to be combined with credible death threats that are specifically connected to the racism or, you know, the racial stuff. So she didn't rise to that level. And that was it with the FBI. But then at a later stage, an NYPD detective offered to get involved. He was very sympathetic. He'd had some similar kinds of dealings with some similar kinds of people. And he was the one who explained, though, that actually there wasn't that much he could do because she was in California. But he did say that he would call her up and try to basically shock her into or scare her into stopping. But he said it's a bluff because the likelihood is if she doesn't take any notice, the likelihood is we won't actually be able to extradite her. Yeah. And he called her up finally, and she did slow down. She did quieten down for a while, not for very long. I mean, she immediately continued emailing, but she sort of lowered the tone of them, became less threatening for a while. Yeah. But gradually, I think she realized that nothing was going to happen to her, and so she resumed. And then, and basically, that was all that detective could do. Since I finished the book, the case has been taken up actually by a detective at the hate crimes unit of the NYPD who's now has it under investigation. And it's great to have somebody involved from the police, not just me and here. I mean, there's these two other women who've been getting these emails and these threats. And it's some comfort to have a law enforcement on the case, but they're basically up against the same problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Although she has escalated her threats to a level that makes it potentially possible for them to extradite her.
So you have an extreme difficulty reconciling her online persona and her real life behavior, that you interacted with her in the class and the few times that you met with her to talk about her work afterwards. You devote, you know, a lot of thinking into replaying these encounters over and over, looking for clues. And with hindsight, you know, and as you sort of pored over every detail, what did you discover? Were there warning signs?
I don't know if there were warning signs that came at a point where anything could have been done about it. Because I think by the time it became evident to me that there was something disturbing going on, there was something disturbing going on. And I don't know if there's anything I could have done before that, realistically, or would have done realistically, that would have stopped it. I mean, the only thing that I could have done, it would have been when she first contacted me after 2 years and asked me to help her with a novel, instead of just saying, no, but I'll put you in touch with my agent, I either shouldn't have replied or I've just said no and I'm not going to help you. This was a student I'd encouraged who'd got in touch with me after 2 years. You don't behave like that. So I don't know. But what I did see was things that I hadn't really thought about before that might have played a part in what happened. Although I don't think anything that I did explains 5 years of unrelenting malice.
Might have explained it. I mean, it's key. I mean, you spend the whole book trying to understand, you know, why is this happening to you, and why did you deserve this? But it for us, it's an extra impossible task because, you know, we are stuck with your telling of the tale. We don't have hers. And you know, you are able to show us some of the emails that she sends you, but you're missing the ones from the beginning when the conversation was more amicable. You didn't save those, or
oh no, some of them. I have got some of them in the book. I put a few representative samples of that in the book.
But I'm almost for yourself. You were missing those. Were you thinking, you know, as you were sort of going over these initial encounters, did you wish that you had some of those earlier emails? Or
I mean, they wouldn't have revealed much. I mean, there was nothing in them that was that different from the first ones that I do quote. I mean, sure, if I'd had a complete record, I suppose there might be something in it that would tip me off. But I don't think maybe I don't know. Huh. The answer is I don't know, but I'm inclined to think not. I mean, what I was interested in was rethinking, for instance, the dynamic of the classroom. I mean, I've never taken a creative writing course, but I've taught them for years, and I go in, I teach them, I do the best job I can, and you know, but I've never really thought about what goes on in a class from the student's point of view before this experience. And in the, you know, part of the, what I did in the process of kind of going back over everything, trying to look for explanations, was try to think my way into what it is to submit your writing to a writing teacher. I mean, even if you're not in a class, when you show somebody your work as a writer, it is a very fraught kind of action. You're giving them something that's very close to you, very intimate, part of your psyche, and their reaction is vested with a huge amount of emotion on your part. You have an awful lot at stake, not just in kind of practical terms. You know, does this part work? Does that part work? But at a more fundamental level, you know, am I any good? And I think that I maybe underestimated how kind of charged that transaction is.
Yeah, but you have taught a number of classes, and you liked her work. Yeah. I mean, it really seems that's sort of a dead end for you in the book. It really comes down to what you share with us, is that the only thing, you come to the conclusion that she is angry because she feels scorned. And that seems to be the answer you come up with.
Well, I would say the answer that I come up with is that there's something absolutely mysterious about it in the end. I mean, yes,
There is the irrational, she kind of loses it, but the one where you actually try to have something concrete to hold on to.
I think that the the classroom thing is a part of it. I think that my silence was much more, a much bigger thing for her than I realized at the time. That's something that I didn't give much thought to. I mean, I just gradually stopped answering her emails because they were just too many to answer, and I just felt this is becoming kind of ridiculous, and you know, maybe I'll answer when they let up, and she kind of stops this nonsense, but she never did, and then it just turned to this kind of hate mail. I wasn't going to answer that, but I do think that, you know, someone you've been in friendly contact with who then becomes silent, that's probably, you know, if you're a vulnerable person, I wanted to see, I felt implicated in this. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, part of that is just you do. If something bad happens to you, it's very, over time and this bad, it's very hard to think of it as a completely random event. You start looking for explanations. You start trying to understand it. And part of that is actually looking for a cause, but part of it is also just saying to yourself, well, what is this like? What other experiences is this like? And I think actually most of the book is about that part of it. It's just my filtering it through other experiences of mine in life and in literature. So, I mean, I look at it through the prism of various stories, myths, poems. And in a way, I think I get closer to an understanding just by that kind of exploration of similar experiences.
Yeah, specifically about the idea or the theme of the scorned woman. I mean, you spend a lot of time from D.H. Lawrence in literature and The Legend of the Green Knight to your own experiences. I mean, it seems that, you know, just by following those examples and those threads, that this is something you really came to understand, that this is something that she says you did.
Yeah, I think, she doesn't say that.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. This is something that you feel that explains things for you.
I do. I think rejection, is what she is sort of the underlying thing that she felt, and I mean, she was emphatic that later on she was emphatic that, you know, she wasn't interested in me, but I had stolen her work and I'd had her drugged and raped.
Yes. So,
but I think underlying those fabrications is a feeling of profound rejection, and I mean, to the extent that I looked into the sort of psychiatric aspect of it and into kind of various personality disorders, particularly borderline personality, which I think possibly is the category she falls into, although I say that very, you know, tentatively, rejection is a very difficult thing for people who have that disorder to deal with.
So know. I have some friends who teach in creative writing programs too, and last time I checked, the number one fear they have is perhaps the consequences of getting involved with a student. It seems the last thing they're thinking about is the consequences from not getting involved.
Yeah, but I never even thought about, I didn't really think about that.
Yeah.
I didn't think about either side of it.
I mean, I know, but it just seems that this is terrifying. Yeah. You are doomed no matter what.
Yeah, yeah.
But you mentioned one of the accusations she had was you stealing her work, and it was a big thing that she kept coming in, that you were selling this to these other young Iranian women that were, you know, just crazy accusations. But then, and you address this, it seems that you have a whole finished product that is based on your experiences with her.
Yeah, well, that is an irony of the situation,
and
of course I mention it in the book, that here's somebody who's accused me of plagiarism, and here I am with a book that's full of her emails. So.
Did you think about, you know, you write fiction as well, did you think about perhaps channeling this into something else? When did you sort of make the decision that, all right, I just have to just, this is going to be, because you let us know many times during the book that you are trying to stick 100% to the facts. There's a story about an earlier episode that happens to you about a collapsed lung, and you're like, wow, if I could sort of move that here, it would work perfectly. But then you kind of get it both ways, and that you put it in there as well.
Yeah, but and then I say, well, I can't put it in here. Yeah, well, I, you know.
Amazing. No, it's a feat. It's very impressive.
Well, you know, I felt, no, I mean, I, the idea of writing this as a novel, I mean, maybe I turned it over in my mind for a few seconds, but I, you know, it wouldn't have, I don't think it would have been credible, plausible as a novel. I just don't think it would have worked. And so, you know, if I was going to write it as a factual thing, it had to be absolutely true. I was, nevertheless, you know, a lot of it is inside my own head. And when you're writing about stuff that's inside your own head, it can become very easily rather abstract and ethereal and undramatic. And I, you know, so you're always looking for ways to convey inward experience dramatically. And so I had toyed, you know, in the section where I was trying to kind of convey how burdened I felt and how overwhelmed and how absolutely this had taken over my life and was crushing me, which is what I felt. My thoughts went to this much earlier episode in my life where I had experienced a collapsed lung, and it was like a kind of implosion, like a physical implosion. And I had thought, well, you know, maybe if I could put that here, that would convey dramatically. And then I realized, well, you know, I can't do that. But in the process of saying so, I suppose I'd conveyed something of what I was feeling.
Yeah. So before the internet, you know, a writer like yourself could publish a book like this using pseudonyms, as you do, and feel pretty confident that the vast majority of your readers would never uncover or be able to connect to the real persons or real institutions. But especially when it comes to literature in New York City and our gossip culture, it's, and I haven't researched this yet, but it seems that there has to be, you know, there are websites dedicated to sort of connecting these dots. Has this happened yet, or have you aware of that, or were you worried about that? Or, I mean, surely you knew that that probably would happen, or did that?
You mean in disclosing the identity of Nasreen?
Yeah.
No, I didn't particularly give that much, a lot of thought. Give that a lot of thought, but I felt that she would probably come forward. I mean, she's never exactly been bashful about these accusations.
And has she yet?
No, she hasn't. And you know, maybe she's sort of moved on to other things. Maybe I don't know what's. Yeah. I have no way of knowing what's going on.
Yeah.
I felt. And, you know, I had to disguise everybody's identity. I mean, this was not an attempt to get revenge on her, to attack her, I actually feel it's quite sympathetic to her. I mean, obviously, her words are very damning in many ways, but I think that they also can evoke some sympathy in readers. She's obviously, you know, writing from a point of view of great suffering. I think that's fairly obvious, but... but at the same time, she's causing enormous harm.
Yeah.
And not just to me. But yeah, I mean, yeah, these things exist. What can one do about them? That's the nature. That's part of the story.
Sure. But it almost seems that those real-world gossip sites almost take your protected pseudonym book and put it firmly in the real world, which for a book that you're writing about defending your own reputation seems perhaps... an added benefit.
Maybe.
Well, yeah. So I want to come back to this, you know, idea of internet stalking and bullying, and to use Nasreen's phrase, terrorism. You know, we're reading stories about this all the time now, but this is the first, you know, really deep tale taken on from, you know, looking at literature. But you know, the thing that sheer terror you have of not knowing why this is happening, this is actually what's at the heart of every stalking case. It seems that many, many people who are terrorized by trolls and internet stalkers, they finally discover that there is no reason, there is no answer to why. That question is not answerable. It could be some kid having a game, someone having a laugh. Like the questions you ask about why are not answerable.
I think that's very possible. But I think you can, you know, you can get yourself to a position where you understand a little more by asking.
Sure.
You can bring other experiences at least to shed light on what's going on. But and I think in some case, I mean, I've heard a lot since I published this book. I've encountered so many people who've had some kind of stalking experience, cyber stalking or not. And so in some cases, it is very clear. You know, it's a love affair that's gone sour.
Sure.
The person is angry or upset and they stalk them for a bit and it usually ends. So there are cases where, I mean, does that answer why the person stalked? Perhaps not. No. I think there is some kind of mentality there that is drawn that finds it irresistible to go after a person, that becomes obsessive, that projects huge amounts onto another person with whom they have been in, you know, some way, whether purely in their own minds. Close.
Yeah.
And some people have that and some people don't. I think perhaps many people are capable of tilting into that kind of behavior as an aberration. What's unusual is for it to take over and become something that goes on for years and years and years.
And that's the thing where I think they all connect together. There is no answer for that. So maybe it started off that this is my ex-professor or this is my ex-girlfriend, but then the level of violence and hate that comes out of it, that's where it comes full circle, and everyone can agree that there may not be an answer. But what I find really comforting about your book is that as we meditate on that there might not be an answer to why, does that perhaps tell us how to act? I'm wondering if we can learn, if you feel, you know, having gone through this experience for someone dealing with that there not being an answer, is that perhaps a lesson for others? Or is there perhaps a lesson on how to act?
Well, you have to do something about it, whether there's an explanation for it or not. If somebody's going after you, if they're threatening you with harm, or if they're trying to damage your name online or whatever, I mean, you got to do something about it, whether you understand it or not. I'm personally in favor of trying to find out everything, trying to look as hard as you can, trying to investigate as hard as you can. But I mean, I'm a writer, and that's sort of what my instinct is.
But that is a question you don't answer in the book. I mean, you don't have. I mean, as much as you time
no,
as
no.
you spend investigating this, no. there is no answer to why
don't think
she
there
did
is.
This.
I don't think there is ultimately not a clear answer.
No. Yeah, so it seems that in China we have a growing awareness that a lot of internet studies that have been done there is that when it comes to online accusations, they are having they can do a lot of damage. A lot more damage than it seems here, someone saying like, oh, do you beat your wife, Jane? You know, whereas there it seems that stalkers or people who want to harass are discovering that they can cause all kinds of damage by simply putting an anonymous posting, and perhaps their ideas of reputation and face are different than ours. But I'm wondering, as you sort of dove into the idea of reputation defense, are we heading in that direction as well?
I don't know, but it's obviously the internet has brought all these questions up. I mean, it's brought huge benefits, but it's introduced a whole new panoply of potential harms. It's also facilitated people who I think of themselves as very powerless. It's enabled them to wield disproportionate amounts of power if they want to. I mean, you know, you can be alone in your room and inflict an enormous amount of harm on all kinds of people through the internet if you want to, and some people find that irresistible. Is there a way of dealing with it? I don't know. I'm not in favor of legislating the internet. I don't think you could, even if you wanted to, censoring stuff. I mean, I think that some places, like for instance The Guardian, like very reputable curated sites, ought to be vigilant about what gets posted on them. But all the other sites, I don't know. I think we're probably moving towards more a kind of replication of what happened in the old world before the virtual world, which is where you have reputable places that are curated that people go to for their information, and people learn to trust certain places and to totally dismiss the information offered by other places or the postings offered by other places. But maybe not.
I don't see. I mean, if you just think of like the Obama birth certificate story where it's just the number of people who still believe that he was born in Kenya.
That's even right. No, it's incredibly depressing. Maybe we'll get to a point where nobody gives a damn about what anybody says about them anymore. And maybe that's going to be...
Is that possible, though? I mean, as someone who had... I mean, you had dark nights where you were thinking, okay, maybe if I just ignored this, I could get on to other things. I mean, you seem to be saying that even if you don't know why, you can't ignore it. I mean, that seems to be one of the big lessons you have for us.
I couldn't ignore it because I just felt I was being harmed. And I certainly couldn't ignore it when it rose to the level of actual threats against my family. Yeah, the smearing thing, the troll thing, I don't know. It's a problem that society's been saddled with by this new technology. And, you know, codes of conduct will emerge. I suppose there'll be some of it will sort itself out. Like, for instance, I think cyberbullying at the school level is being dealt with at the school level. And I think you're going to get generations of kids who are so positively indoctrinated against doing it that they just wouldn't do it. I mean, I think we've lost a generation, right, probably. But I think you'll probably see less of that kind of thing now, because I know they're going into schools, they're talking to them, they're getting kids at impressionable ages where they'll take this stuff on. And I think all but the really crazy, damaged kids...
A big percentage of kids in this country will stop.
Yeah, but I mean, I think you can get to a bully when they're young.
Okay.
And I think you can turn them around. I know, I do. I really do. But I think it's always going to be very approximate, and there is always going to be stuff that just can't be controlled.
Yeah. Do you feel that having this book published gives you the final say in this story? That, in other words, anyone who Googles you thinking that they come across some posting that she had on any site, sort of finding you with this book, you're safe? I mean, do you feel protected with your reputation because, you know, you now have this published book on the record? Does that give you solace that this is...
Well, it's the book I wanted to write. If people want to read it, it contains the story. But, you know, people are always going to look for other sources of information. She might come out with a book.
I know, but that's not going... Yeah, but I'm saying for you personally.
For me personally,
do you feel
yes,
that this is like a protection? Not just a great published not a book you did, but do you feel protected by this book?
I do, to some extent. I feel that it's my answer to any of these kind of allegations that get around.
James Lasden's new book, Give Me Everything You Have, is published by FSG. That's it for this week's edition of Too Much Information. Special thanks to James Lasden and Paolo Ventura. You can find archives of the program and subscribe to the podcast at WFMU.org. And you should give a listen to my other podcast, The Theory of Everything. It's brand new, and that's where all of the strange stuff you used to hear here on this program lives now. You'll find that at toe.prx.org.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in Rockland County, at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for Nardwar, the human serviette.
Jungle!
Nardwar! Nardwar!
Hello there. This is a representative from the Century Record Manufacturing Company speaking to you. Since 1951, we have written to the music department of your school and most of the schools in the United States and offered them the opportunity of purchasing at low cost records of their performances. Along with the great popularity of phonograph records, our business has grown each year until now we are the largest manufacturer of custom phonograph records in the country. In the past few years, we have witnessed a revolutionary change in the record business. The old 78 RPM record has all but disappeared, and the high-fidelity 12-inch LP now accounts for about 70% of all record sales. Along with high fidelity is the importance of modern-day marketing, and most important and interesting to you, packaging. The package for the 12-inch LP is the album cover. In the past, the record itself has been considered all-important. But from actual research, it has been found that the eye appeal of the record jacket accounts for about 50% of all sales. In many instances, it is the record album alone which sells the record. Last year, at least half of the organizations that we did work for inquired about albums for their records. This year, we are confident that even more will want them. After long consideration, we have decided that we should write to the art departments of each school and encourage them to design and print the record jackets. Just think of the wonderful opportunity this plan offers to develop the talents of art students. Also, the albums will be exactly what is wanted, as your artists will be right on the spot and supervise the production from start to finish. We are confident that your art students will derive much satisfaction from producing these beautiful albums to hold the records of your school's dance band, a cappella choir, orchestra, or band. Then, of course, there is the chance to raise a substantial amount of money for your school. The potential for the sale of phonograph records in your community is unlimited. Records have become a part of almost every American home, and you will have an added sales factor, that of local interest in your musical organization. Your list of prospective customers will include students and their friends and relatives, the alumni, and residents of your community. Even though you have this ready-made market, there must still be organized sales effort, and this effort must be coordinated by an outstanding individual. Once this person is selected, he must have the help of a large organization, as every potential customer must be contacted. We have found from experience that direct sales with personal contact is by far the most effective way to sell your records. In many instances, it is advisable to decide where the profits are to go, such as a building fund, scholarships, and so forth, and then build your sales campaign around this theme. Direct mail and advertising in newspapers and local stores will help your sales. In most cases, space and time will be donated as a contribution to the project. Let us stress again, the way to sell records is by direct contact. On the other side of this record are full instructions to help you design and print the fronts and backs of the albums. We cut and trim the printed sheets and wrap them around a special cardboard to make the record album. This information is also contained in the enclosed price list. We are sending recording information to the musical organizations of your school as well as price lists. If by chance they have been lost or you need more, please write and we will send this information to you immediately. Now to summarize. Inspect the workmanship on this sample record. The records and albums we make for you will be of the same high quality. We have an unconditional guarantee on the quality of our work. We require no money in advance, and the completed records and albums are sent to you open account. You are not expected to send us a check until you have received the albums, inspected them, and decided if they are all we have said they would be. We know you will be happy with the results. You have everything to gain and nothing to lose. Souvenir records and a surefire method to make money and not a penny's risk financially. Act now. Present this plan to your art students and meet together with your music department as soon as possible. You will probably find that your band, orchestra, and choirs will all want to make records and albums, producing your album covers. For the most satisfying results and the lowest cost, let your art department design your albums and have the printing done by your school or local print shop. You send the printed fronts and backs to us, and we wrap them around special cardboard to form the album. The following information will help you produce your albums. The printing specifications are shown in our enclosed price list. There are unlimited ideas for record albums. Probably the first thing you should do is examine the record albums at your local record store. This will also give you more information on how they're constructed. From experience, we have found that you will have much greater success using photographs with some artwork than you will using all artwork. For a very simple yet attractive album, use a good photograph with your name on the front. Unless your organization plans to make thousands of albums, full-color printing is too expensive. With a little ingenuity, you may obtain excellent results with one- or two-color printing. Reverse printing, showing the color of the paper used, is very effective. We hope that these few suggestions will help you get started. We know that once this project is organized, you'll be able to think up much better ideas. Good luck. How to record. When you record, it is important to always remember that the records we make for you are a near-perfect reproduction of the tapes you send us. For this reason, much effort must be expended to furnish us with high-fidelity tapes. Trial and error is probably the best method to find out the best tape recording procedures. With modern tape machines and microphones, excellent results are easily obtainable by experimenting with the best possible microphone placement and physical recording setup. Always, what you hear is the final test. If it sounds good, that is the best way to do it. Recording volume is probably the most serious problem encountered, and the biggest surprise to us is that nearly always the recording level is too low. Too much volume is, of course, very bad and will cause distortion. The results sound fuzzy and indistinct. But too little volume is bad also, as it makes it necessary for us to increase the playback volume, and thus increases background noises, mainly room and tape noise. Unless you're quite familiar with multiple microphone techniques, it's best to use one good non-directional microphone. In fact, many engineers believe this is the best way to record no matter what equipment you have. Do not try to economize on a microphone. A good rule is to use a microphone worth 25 to 50% of the value of your tape machine. When you have excessively bright sound resulting from bad acoustical conditions, the overstrong echoes and reverberations can often be reduced by placing rugs on the floor and heavy draperies on the walls. In auditoriums which are dead, the reverse is true. These expedients alleviate bad situations, but only partially. There is no substitute.